we go. If we do that, that'll be better. Yeah, well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on autonomousmedia.net. As you will have gathered, we had one of Dr. Rock's favourite intros to a show there with plenty of technical hassle. We may slide away because the internet here, we're on a bit of a thin pipe, which is strange because we're in quite a metropolitan area, you know. It's a city, Bristol, down in the southwest of England. And I'm joined by a real crew of people who are being actually quieter than they've been since I ran into them earlier. Over the show, we're going to be talking with Humphrey and with Ben and with Steph about various issues about growing food and community and squatting and the life of folks in Bristol. As you know, it's great for me to be in a city, having come in from Mid Wales. What we'll do is have a quick intro, if we could, from each of you, and kick off with you, Humphrey. If you'd like to let us know what you're doing, that would be great.
So my name's Humphrey Lloyd, and I'm a grower here in Bristol. I have a market garden on the outskirts of Bristol and grow mainly salad on a 1 acre county small holding. What I'll mainly be talking about tonight, though, is my work with an organisation called the Land Workers Alliance, which is a producers organisation for small scale farmers, growers and fisher folk in the UK. And we are essentially about raising the profile of ecological food production and promoting it as a political issue.
Hello there, my name is Ben Ritchie. I'm one of the people involved in the squatting group in Bristol, Bristol Housing Action Movement. And we're involved with homeless people, travellers, squatters, and those who face difficulties in paying their rent. We're very busy, as you know, because Bristol's got a tremendous housing problem. And we're involved in a number of projects, including things like the famous free shop, where we just gave anything away that we got given to us and collected even more stuff to give away. So we'd like to talk about housing, land, and making sure that everyone has a roof over their head.
I'm Steph Weatherall. I wear a number of different hats, kind of in food in and around Bristol. So I work part-time for a local food co-op where we source food directly from local producers and distribute it to members around the city. I also work for an organisation called Bristol Food Producers, where we kind of support local producers and we're aiming to increase local food production in and around the city. And another organisation called Beacon Farms, who are trying to secure land and protect some of the kind of best agricultural soils around the city and help new entrants get onto the land. And I'm also a writer and I spend a lot of time interviewing farmers and producers in the area, kind of telling their stories and trying to connect people with the food that they are eating.
That's really great. Thank you all three. I'm very much looking forward to hearing all of that. We'll kick off with you though, Steph. Although anybody else who wants to join in, if you think you've got something to add, then feel free to take the mic. You're obviously doing loads of different things there. Shall we start off by talking a little bit about why you're obviously very, very busy. What was it that led you to these particular projects? Because it sounds like you did many, many interesting things before.
Yes, I was working in kind of sustainable building about 5 years ago and kind of got more and more interested in alternative living generally. And I did a project for a year, which I called deconsumerism, which was jokingly about trying to like rid my life of consumerism. And it wasn't about not spending money. It was about being aware of where I spent money and kind of being responsible in that. And as part of that, I stopped going to supermarkets and started being aware, more aware of where the food I came from was. And I went woofing for the first time, which stands for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms, which is where you go and volunteer on farms in exchange for room and board. And I just really loved it. I really enjoyed it. I went to a rare breed pig farm just outside of Bristol and I had the best time. And around that time I was just turning 30 and kind of felt the need for a bit of an adventure. So I quit my job and bought a one-way plane ticket to Canada with a plan to kind of spend about 6 months, maybe a year, kind of woofing and travelling across Canada. And I ended up staying for 2.5 years and I ended up getting really involved in a farm there and farming for a year and a half.
They can be wacky big farms in Canada. What sort of stuff were they doing there?
That farm was a pretty small scale one. So it was 160 acres, bit of a mixed use farm. So it had some cattle, some sheep. We had a dairy cow called Ellie Mae, who we used to milk by hand, some chickens, a little market garden, some wayward goats.
All goats are wayward. I remember hearing a story about a kind of petting zoo that had some goats and people kept giving them food. So they put up a big plywood sign saying, please do not feed the goats. One of the goats died because it ate the plywood sign. So was that farm kind of, I know a lot of farms of that kind of scale are actually capable of being pretty much self-sufficient. Was it a closed cycle farm or were they dealing with other farms around them?
It was pretty closed cycle for veg, meat, dairy, eggs. It was pretty much closed. It's quite challenging during the winter over there, though, because the winters are quite long and quite cold. So it's quite difficult to be vegetable self-sufficient if you don't have proper kind of cold store. I did spend a winter, my first winter in Canada, I spent it on a farm that was completely self-sufficient. So during the winter, all we ate was anything that was still in the ground or whatever people had preserved earlier in the year, for which I was very thankful.
I think probably the subject of preservation is one for another show, because it's that would be an interesting challenge there. And again, it's something that I'm aware we've lost here, is the ability to preserve things naturally. But perhaps you'd better move on. So eventually you came back to Bristol. But you were in Canada for a couple of years?
Yeah, and when I was in Canada, I just, like, the whole way I ate and the whole way I related to food had kind of completely changed. Like, I knew where all my food came from and my relationship to that had completely transformed. And so I'd started working in the local food movement in the area out there. I ran a few conferences about food. And so when I came back to Bristol, it seemed like a natural thing to do. Like, I got to the city and I was like, oh, I was kind of used to knowing where everything I ate came from. And suddenly I was living in a city where everything came from a shop. So I started my website and I decided to set out and meet all the people who were making the food that I was eating. And kind of through that, I've ended up doing all of the other jobs and all of the other projects that I've been doing.
And what was the website called?
It's called The Locavore, like omnivore, carnivore, locavore. And I've been doing that for about a year now, and I've met some really amazing local producers and, yeah, told some really great stories. And it's amazing now when I eat, like, I know where everything comes from, and it's a completely different experience.
Have you noticed difference in your health as a result of eating all of your own food, or food that you know where it's come from?
Yeah, completely. I went to Canada. When I went to Canada, I was taking medication that I'd been given blindly by my doctor without really understanding it. And when I was in Canada, I stopped taking it and started eating a really amazing organic diet and got a lot better.
So presumably that's what led you to being involved in the actual growing and distribution of food. What was the first move that you made to start generalising your own experience?
I think for me, the first thing I did was starting writing about it, because to me, that's such something that I love. And like, I realised, you know, when I was farming, I realised I didn't actually want to be a farmer. Like, I love farmers. I have so much respect for them. But while I still want to be involved in the food system, it's not kind of my life path. But realizing that actually by telling people stories and by connecting people to the food that I could help other people form that connection that I myself had made and had made a big difference to me.
And these interviews you had with farmers, are they a kind of podcasts or recordings of those available? And do you feel that they learnt from you and perhaps changed some of their behaviour as a result of talking to you?
They're available as written, not as podcasts. I don't have the recording equipment for that, and it's too much of me talking. I think sometimes it's interesting when you have a conversation and somebody doesn't realise how remarkable what they're doing is. So I went to visit a farm called Model Farm, who are out near Ross-on-Wye, who do pasture-reared beef and lamb and pork, and it's a truly incredible place. It's one of the most amazing farms I've ever been to. They're doing some amazing, like, holistic land management. They're restoring land and bringing back biodiversity. You know, the animals are out on the field year round. It's really, really remarkable. They lamb in the fields, they carve in the fields. And, you know, I think talking to the farmer and I think seeing his reaction to my reaction, it was like, you know, I think he forgets what a remarkable thing he's doing and how different it is to the conventional farming system, or even to most, even organic farms. He's like well ahead of that in what he's doing.
Yeah, Humphrey.
So, Steph, can you tell us a bit about their grazing regime at Model Farm?
Yes, yeah, so he does rotational grazing. So they've got about 500 acres, and he moves the cows and the sheep through the field. So he doesn't do really, really intensive mob grazing like they do in some places because of the layouts of the field. There's quite a lot of footpaths and rivers. It's quite difficult to do that. But he moves them every week or so into a new pasture. And he doesn't, he's really careful about not overgrazing the fields. So that is why the animals can stay out year round, because there's enough cover on the ground that they don't start chopping up the soil and stuff. But he's planted all these wildflowers, which has brought back all the insects, which has brought back all the birds, and the land has gone from being like almost dead to just being full of life. You walk through the field and there's insects flying away ahead of you and stuff.
That's excellent. So that means basically, I guess, that some of the fields are effectively left fallow and then cropped for hay, either early or later in the year. I see when people lamb in Wales and the farmers have such a criminal time of it. Do those people lamb later?
No, he lambs at the normal time, but he just lets them lamb in the field and doesn't really intervene. And by that, he feels like he's breeding in strong, resilient genetics into his crop, into his flock, sorry. And and that he's getting, because if you take a ewe that's had a difficult birth and you take that lamb, then a lot of people think that you're bringing in the kind of difficult genetics. And so, yeah, he's just breeding resilient genetics in. And if one of his first year ewes has two lambs, a lot of people will like hand bottle rear that lamb. He just gives them away to someone. So he lambs 300 odd sheep on his own, just in the field. And his days are spent driving around in a Land Rover checking on his animals, which seems pretty idyllic.
It sounds like at least one or two of those interviews might benefit from being turned into an audio experience, which is something that I'd be interested in helping with, because we can do that sort of thing. Because it's not only really good for us to hear from farmers who are farming soundly, it's really good to have things you can give to other farmers for them to listen to, I think. And that sounds like a really exciting part of what you've been doing to me.
Yeah, you know, it really is. And there's actually a couple of really exciting podcasts around that kind of stuff that are around. There's a really amazing one called Farmerama, which has been going just over a year now, but is really good for that respect. It's about telling people stories, but it's also like really full of information as well, and a lot to learn from.
And where do people find that?
Farmerama. Just look it up. it's spelt like it sounds. Yeah.
Okay, well, in the meantime, whilst I have a quick look and see if I can't find that. So how did you start this? Presumably all of this, this kind of external information helps you devise the schemes that you're now involved in. It's quite a complex business, I would have thought, to set about, as you put it, basically gathering local food and distributing it. That sounds like a very easy sentence. What sort of challenges did you experience in the early stages of that minor undertaking?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. And one of the most challenging thing is making sure that farmers are getting a fair price for their food. Because I think, we live somewhere where we're competing, everyone's constantly competing with cheap supermarket prices. And so to create something where farmers can be given a fair price, but also trying to create some kind of consistent demand for farmers as well. The local food co-op has about 12 different producers and a number of members around the city. But when we first started, it was quite difficult to build the producers when we didn't yet have much of a demand, but you won't get the customers if you don't have a good range of producers. So I'm really grateful for the producers who stuck with us in that kind of early period.
So as a food producer myself, talking on the issue of the price that farmers get for their produce, the amount that farmers get for the amount that we spend in shops these days has now dropped to 9p in the pound that we spend on food in the UK. Okay, this has happened at the same time as since 2003, the amount that we pay for food as consumers has risen 12%. Okay, so there's basically been a bifurcation between the amount that we spend as consumers and the amount that farmers get at the farm gate. And the reason for that is essentially the monopoly that a few supermarket retailers have, which has now got to the stage where 8 supermarket retailers control 95.8% of the retail market in the UK.
Interestingly enough, I was commenting just the other week, I've been dealing with the local transition towns people where we live, and one of them vouchsafed to me that Tesco's actually has one of the most low-carbon distribution chains on the planet. He seemed to think this was important. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, it's it's like the tip of the iceberg, really, isn't it? If you're screwing everyone over before you get to that point, So, one of the things that, about the price I'm really pleased about is, you know, Humphrey said that from supermarkets, farmers get 9p. With the food co-op I work for, they get 82p. So that's significant improvement. And the other thing is, as well as the amount that farmers are getting being so low, you also have to bear in mind that land prices have tripled. Agricultural land prices have tripled in the last 10 years. So that's like a huge extra cost for most farmers and a real barrier to creating a viable business for people.
As you know, I'm getting involved, as we talked about a bit off air, I'm getting involved in a land trust that have got actually plenty of capacity for turning out veg. And we've got several small retailers who'd be willing to take it on board. I think the biggest problem the retailers have had, and actually the land trust as well, is predictability of supply. The customer, the people who are getting the veg, need to know they're going to get it or when then they're going to not get it anymore. How do you deal with that sort? Because obviously, well up and down, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, so we deal with a weekly ordering system. So people order over the weekend, basically, for delivery on a Thursday. So it's reliant on producers updating their list regularly as to what's available, which, you know, is extra work for them. But still, you know, we really try and do a lot of education with our customers as to why sometimes these things happen. You know, like we would do a lot of education around the Hungry Gap, which is kind of usually runs from about kind of March through till June, when there's not a lot growing in the UK, and people can't quite seem to get their heads around that they can't get they can't get everything they want. And I think that's one of the things supermarkets have done to us, is that they've taught us that we can have exactly what we want when we want it. You can have your sugar snap peas in December, you can have your strawberries in February.
Get yourself bloody lucky. When I was a kid, you couldn't even get that stuff in the summer. It is true. The Hungry Gap is a major problem, isn't it? It's not something that we can realistically entirely expect to address, apart from by storage, really, it seems to me. And in all honesty, there still are a surprising amount of things that you can grow in the Hungry Gap, aren't there? Like the Japanese greens and...
Yeah, and I found that when I started eating seasonally, I feel like my body got in tune with it again. I feel like it's something that has been completely lost in the way that we eat in this country, in the kind of Western world generally. But when I started eating it again, it's kind of weird. Like, I realized that actually seasonally, it's normal to eat quite a lot of meat in the winter, if you're a meat eater, obviously. Because your animals are butchered in the autumn and there's lots of root vegetables. And then come the spring and come the summer, we were almost vegetarian on the farm and we ate a lot of dairy because the cow was producing so much. But now I find that I can't stop doing it. You know, it gets to the winter and I reach for the kale and the carrots and the beetroot, and I eat kale salads a lot. And it just seems to be what my body wants. And then as soon as we get to the spring, I'm just like, if anyone shows me a piece of kale, I'm just going to scream. But you start craving those bitters, and, you know, like what nature provides in the spring is things like dandelions and stuff, which are good for your body to cleanse from that kind of rich winter food. So.
And of course, you can cleanse on the way to the winter food with the apples. But yeah, Humphrey.
So it's a related point to what Steph was just saying, but just this role of animals in terms of food storage in the kind of northern European climate in which we live. And that, strangely, we've very much come to associate local eating exclusively with vegetables, which is quite a weird sort of late 20th century thing, really. Whereas, as Steph's saying, you know, as it comes into winter and vegetables are less available, that's when your meat and your dairy products are absolutely crucial. And that's where the role of livestock really comes in holistic farming systems. Because what the cow, for example, does is transform something that is freely available all year round, grass, into a nutritious foodstuff that we can eat, milk. And meat is another example. And so as we start to think about, you know, sourcing locally and eating locally, let's not just think about vegetables. Let's think about the whole suite of options we've got in terms of agricultural production in the UK. And that involves meat and it involves dairy too.
Yeah. Whilst we've got meat eaters, we might as well make use of them.
I think my biggest learning of living on a small holding was the changing way I viewed milk. When I realised that cheese was a way to store milk, it was like my mind was blown, because like it turns out a cow produces a lot of milk, like a lot in peak flow in the middle of the summer, just after it's calved, a lot of milk, more than you can drink, like for a fairly large group of people.
Yeah, people will remember I worked at a farm and I was actually milking the cow because it turned out to be another thing that I could just do, sat down and milk this cow. What a lovely way of starting a day with your forehead and the flank of a warm animal. But yeah, she was producing 8 gallons a day. 8 gallons a day from a single cow. It was stunning.
But then realising that cheese is your way to store that. Yes. It's your way to store that over time. And it suddenly became this whole different world. Humphrey's waving cheese in the air. It's this whole different way to view what we consider like this really kind of quick product that, you know, it's just something you drink. And yeah, just changed the way that I viewed that and that part of the system. And I mean, I eat meat, but I eat a small amount of meat and I'm fairly choosy about where it comes from. But, you know, living on that farm, it made sense because every animal that we had a role. Like we had a Jersey cow for the dairy, but if we wanted to milk her, we also like had to have calves, and though, you know, we could eat them. And the chickens ate a lot of the scraps, and you know, we would move them around the pasture and they'd keep a lot of the pests off. And the pig was just the kind of dumping ground for everything, and they're just so good at, you know, eating the stuff that you can't do anything else with and turn it into protein.
Can I just jump in on that and pose the question? Does anyone know why it is we have a piggy bank rather than a monkey bank or a cow bank or anything else?
Because they all used to have a pig, which was shared amongst the society over the hungry gap, and it was like a bank. In fact, it was actually slightly more useful than a bank.
So the principle comes from the fact that you put in trash and you get out gold. So you put in change into a piggy bank and eventually it yields a great harvest. And essentially the same is true with a real pig.
It's just as they've got a piece of paper here which says since 8000 BC. Do you know what that means, Humphrey?
It's just about the fact that we've had a very long domesticated relationship with the pig, arguably longer than any other animal. And so I believe Mesopotamian midden grounds reveal the fact that we were domesticating pigs in 8000 BC. Is that correct, Ali?
Absolutely.
So you've got a dozen or so food producers on board, you're keeping them on board, and are you putting it out in veg boxes, are you?
So we've got a load of different producers. We've got veg, dairy, we've got meat, a couple of different meat producers, and then people doing things like chutneys and stuff. So we do, it's a bit like a veg box, but you can get everything. And we have a range of dried goods as well. So it's basically trying to provide an alternative to supermarkets. So a different way that people can shop, they do an online order and then it gets dropped at a collection point around the city. But it's trying to do more than that in the bigger picture as well. It's also trying to bring people back together around food. And so the collection points are each food clubs, and it's trying to encourage people to do stuff together around food, whether that's have a meal or share recipes or do cooking classes. It's doing all of that kind of stuff and trying to bring people back together around the table.
Which I think is totally the crucial bit, is getting people to eat together again, because then they talk together and they're not talking together because they're not eating together, I think. So do the food clubs have regular kind of community meals using the food you're cooking? Do they feed other people as well as themselves? How does that work?
So it's up to the individual food clubs. So we're here to support and encourage whatever our members want to do. So some of them are more active than other ones. For some people, it is just a way to buy their food. But we are also trying to work in some of the areas of the city that don't have such good access to food. There's some real food deserts and some really quite kind of economically deprived parts of the city. And we're trying to bring good food and access to good food and affordable good food back into those areas as well.
Yeah, I became aware recently that your food banks, I think it's now widely known, aren't able to, well, I mean, they shouldn't bloody be there in the first place, but they aren't able to hand out fresh food. Are you able to work any way towards helping to sort that?
So we're actually working on developing a new model based on the Canadian model of community food centres. I mean, they've had food banks in Canada for 30 years, and there's a lot of recognition that while they, you know, they do meet a certain need, it's not creating any systemic change, and it's very kind of much lacking in dignity and nutrition. So the community food centre model is based around bringing people together around food, and they do provide, there was a food aid provision, but it includes fresh fruit and veg, and it also includes usually an element of choice, which brings dignity with it as well. But there's often based around a community meal, there's access to cooking classes, there's drop-in sessions, there's elders groups, there's after-school clubs. And we're developing some really exciting ideas as well around trying to broaden the kind of food provision available as well by looking at working with surplus from local producers and processing it into kind of like healthy ready meals, because not everyone who has a food aid need has access to cooking facilities. A lot of people only have a microwave. So if we can create kind of ready meals, salads, soups, whatever that people can eat and provide healthy food, and also uses up surplus both from local producers and from the wholesale market that we have in Bristol, then that's also like, We're keen to stay away from supermarket waste, because in my view that's a system that's broken and we don't want to get involved in that. We want to be working with the surplus from producers and buying that off them as well at a fair price.
I am absolutely on my knees. We are your disciples. Do you want a radio show? No, that sounds just really amazing. It's one of the reasons why I'm so happy to be back in Bristol, because even when I was here like 30 years ago, it was kind of like that. Although we didn't need to be doing the things that we're doing now, I really don't think. So what about your Beacon Farms? Because that sounds like, in the kind of holarchy, it sounds like you're just stretching a little bit wider with that one. What's the aim of the Beacon Farms project?
So Beacon Farms is about trying to protect some of the grade one and best use kind of soils around Bristol. There's this strip of land that goes up along the edge of the M32, which has been kind of nicknamed the Blue Finger, because on agricultural maps it shows up as blue. And it's, you know, it's slowly being chipped away at. There's land grabs happening on it. Agricultural land prices have gone through the roof. And so Beacon Farms exists to try and protect that land and get new entrants to farming onto it. However, getting land turns out to be really, really hard. So I've only been working on the project. I've been on it for less than a year. But over the last 3 years, there's been 4 different attempts to get land, including buying from a private landlord, leasing from a council, going to auction, and getting a community asset transfer from the council.
It has been my impression for a while that all the people that have the land do not know what to do with it, and that none of the people who do know what to do with the land can get any. Have you got any success stories along those lines?
My experience is all about having the right person. Like, when it comes to councils and bigger organisations, it's about having the right person at the right time. If you have somebody who wants it to happen, they will make it happen. But likewise, if you have people who are resistant to it with large organizations, it can be very, very difficult to make that happen. I mean, with private landowners, I think land is seen as such an asset. I think people can hold on to it very, very tightly, and they're not willing to relinquish control for very long. So one of the problems that we find is that for new entrants to farming, or people just generally looking for land, it's really difficult to get security of tenure. A lot of people will offer you maybe 2-year lease, and not only is that not long enough to invest in the infrastructure needed for the land, it's not long enough to be investing in the soil, which is really, really important. You know, you need at least 10 years security to start doing that. And if you're doing anything interesting and community-based, maybe you might want to access funding. To access most funding, you need at least a 10-year lease to be able to apply for funding. So there's all these massive barriers. And, you know, we have a land seeker survey. So we've asked people who are looking for land to fill in the survey. And we have 45 people on that list who are all looking for land and wanting to do something. And there's just a massive shortage of land, a massive shortage of landowners who are willing to take a risk. And do something a bit different and try something a bit different. And I mean, there are some amazing things going on, but there could be so much more.
It is something that we definitely noticed, the really serious difficulty of getting hold of land. I don't know if or when it's going to change, but I still go back to that example of Lammas, who took over 70 acres of sheep farm, overgrazed sheep moorland, basically, which was getting £3,800 a year. And in 10 years, they're turning over £107,000 of food and education. And they've got a revitalised landscape and all manner of things. I don't know which way we're going to go on that. I know the Land Workers Alliance are working hard towards that. Have we got any kind of internet core where we're actually talking about people's attempts to get hold of land? The Land Magazine's the best source I know.
There's been quite a lot of national activity around this recently. So I've been to two conferences in the last couple of months, which are bringing a lot of people together nationally who are doing really important, really interesting work to have these conversations and to start combining together and trying to get work done on policy. Because I think that's a huge thing. I mean, there's some amazing things that are happening in Scotland right now. And that's because a lot of people have been working really hard to create that policy level change. You know, the communities have now got the right to force sale from an absentee landlord, which is a huge thing. And I mean, I'm not sure that that's quite applicable in the same way in England, but it does show that change is possible and that actually, you know, I think there's a lot to be done at that kind of local level around things like land access, but I think to create really significant change, there has to be changes at a policy level. I think Humphrey can probably speak to that as well.
Yeah, anyone would think they didn't want us to get any land, wouldn't they?
Just to say on this issue of access to land in the UK, potentially we're coming into quite exciting times with leaving the EU and therefore leaving the Common Agricultural Policy. And I'm not one of these people that like wholesale bashes the Common Agricultural Policy, but definitely one impact that it has had is it's definitely driven land concentration in the UK. Okay, that's essentially because if you get paid £250 approximately per acre of land you own, if you have spare capital, you invest it in new land. This is the sort of thing that radicals and anarchists were saying 5 years ago and is now widely recognised in mainstream agricultural economics. So now we're coming into this time when the cap has been guaranteed till 2020. After that, we're not sure what's going to happen with agricultural policy in the UK, but it's definitely going to change. Potentially, we're going to get a kind of policy and fiscal framework that will steer us away from the kind of thing that is driving land concentration. And hopefully this will break up land parcels and make it easier for new entrants to get their hand on a bit of land.
Yeah, I think it's an opportunity probably because I gather from my readings of Private Eye that your average farm now is making something like £30,000 a year, which is absolutely sod all. It's, you know, without subsidies, they get another 20 grand or so in subsidies, but they could basically earn that. Two people could earn that stacking shelves at Tesco's. And it seems to me that that as the subsidies disappear, they're really going to need to be looking at different ways of doing things. And this might well be the kind of point at which the preparatory work you've been doing starts paying off.
And one of the other main challenges of the Common Agricultural Policy is the way the payments are distributed as well. So I think it's under 8 hectares, you're not eligible for anything. And that's where most kind of small scale farmers who are really trying to start something and do something interesting, that's where they're at, and they're the ones who aren't getting supported. And I think new entrants really have the butt end of the stick with land access, no access to cap payments. It's just a mountain of barriers.
It is, and it has to be faced. I mean, I'm aware that a lot of people think that the National Farmers Union is not old money like the aristocracy, but it is. 70% of European subsidies go to the aristocracy because they own the land. And the thing that's driving up the price of the land is that industrialists are buying it as an investment. So you've got people like Dyson buying a chunk of Lincolnshire that is the equivalent to 2 years of land sales in a single contract. And is Mr. Dyson going to be farming the land, do you think, Humphrey?
I'm actually not entirely sure what Mr. Dyson's plans are. But yeah, I definitely agree that, yeah, the fact about people buying land as an investment rather than for its use value to manage it holistically and produce food for our communities is definitely a critical issue.
Very good. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Steph. Obviously, hopefully you'll say a bit more maybe during the show. If not, that was brilliant. I mean, when I listen to the podcast, I'm going to be back to you for another show because that's so brilliant what you're doing. That's the thing, is it's one of the most optimistic kind of summaries I've heard for a long time. The thing is that we're going to have to do it anyway. The thing is, we are going to have to, the money isn't even real. There isn't any money. It's going to disappear with or without the subsidies and the economic what's it. It's only a pseudo economy. It's all a fake. The only thing we can do to make our landing softer is exactly the kind of stuff you're doing. And bloody total congratulations to you, Steph. And thanks very much for making the time to come here. There you go. Hopefully everybody in the chat book, Freeman Jack's put in avoid all chain stores unless entirely unavoidable. Thanks, Jack. And buy unprocessed foods to reduce middleman profiteering. Absolutely right as well. And yeah, it looks like Andy's saying that this lady sounds nearly as posh as our Susie. Righto, well, we're going to have 5 or 10 minutes of music if everything goes according to plan. We're going to kick off with a track called The Ballad of Yorkley Court, which was co-written by our next guest, Humphrey. And you'll have heard Yorkley Court mentioned several times in the show when we've been talking to Stella Berg. It was a totally shameful story that we are no doubt going to return to in the future. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk to you about it a bit as well, Humphrey. But in the meantime, here's the song What Humphrey Helped to Write.
Until the fruits are owned by all the land itself, by none. At Yorkley Court, a disused colliery, where root and branch had reclaimed industry, where free miners once dug the ground, and Warren James the fences down, and the River Severn wound its way out to the sea. And there a band of dreamers did resolve to reawaken Stanley's dream of old. They built their homes from tin and wood, and worked the wasteland best they could, and staked the claim on common good and no man's legal code. Until the fruits are owned by all the land itself by none. And then the local magnate posed to hear, owning lands as far as Severn Bridge, and his jag of polished chrome and tailored suit from Savile Row, the Yorkley Court he'd hoped to grow his lordly acreage. With lawyer and with land agents in pay, and knowledge of which lords the case would sway, he'd built his wealth on forest land, and half the dean passed through his hand, money friends at his command to help things go his way. Until the fruits are owned by all the land itself by none. Despite the fact no legal claim was found to bring Yorkley under these men's bounds, the bailiffs came at break of day with hired goons kept in their pay. Yorkley folk resolved to stay to stand and fight their ground. The hired men and troopers, they were drove from off the farm and back onto the road. The dreamers then they blocked the gates with trucks to form a sail main. So both sides resolved to wait to see what would unfold. Until the fruits are owned by all the land itself by none. A crony meeting it was called, under pretense the discord to resolve. The law and gentry took their seats, agent, magnate, the police, for woman, man and child of Yorkley stood out in the cold. And next this case will come before the court, and there we'll see if justice can be brought. And so all you who take a stand, come spread these words like grains of sand, and keep within your heart and hands the dream of Yorkley Court. Until the fruits are owned by all the land itself by none. Since will the bastard landed on this shore, or British flag foreign lands was born. The gentry's claim upon the land is but the weapons in their hands. The police are the cudgels and the club is all their law. And so the struggle ever carries on, through Dinkelot and back to Bannockburn. For till we've down these fence and wall, then there on earth will freedom rule. Till the fruits are owned by all the land itself by none. until the fruits are owned by all the land itself by hand.
Dr. Rock's radio show on AutonomousMedia.net, and that was Seize the Day and Bastard MasterCard. And before that, we had Jimmy Aldrich and Sid Goldsmith and the Ballad of Yorkley Court. So do you want to tell us a bit about that, Humphrey?
So this is a song from a fantastic album called Night Hours, just released by, as you said, Sid Goldsmith and Jimmy Aldrich only a few months ago. And so this contains a song called The Ballad of Yorkley Court, co-written by Sid Goldsmith and myself. And it tells the story of a local access to land struggle just near to Bristol in the Forest of Dean, pioneered by a group of aspirational new entrant farmers who took on an underused or disused, rather, small holding and attempted to turn it into a common farm. Unfortunately, they came at odds with the local authorities, and after a 4-year attempt to establish this farm, they were eventually turfed off. But they made a heroic struggle there, and it's a great sort of access to land tale of our times. So we thought we would commemorate that in that song.
And at some stage, I really would like to get some people from Yorkley Court Farm around the table to talk about just exactly what happened there, because I realise that it actually is a rich and devious story. It is. I don't think there was actually any reason why the people should actually have been thrown off, and they were doing a pretty good job of being there. And like I say, something I'd really like to look into a bit more detail. But in the meantime, Humphrey is another Bristolian food producer. So what have you been doing, Humphrey, and what got you involved in it in the first place?
So I run a project called Edible Futures, which is a small scale market garden on the outskirts of Bristol. It's a proper sort of peri-urban county smallholding. I rent 1 acre and I produce predominantly salad and vegetables. We sell these to the restaurant trade and also through a community supported agriculture project called Salad Drop. So through that scheme, basically we entice members of the public to sign up, and then they pay a weekly or monthly subscription and get a bag of really sexy, diverse salad 44 weeks of the year.
Off 1 acre. Man, I'm well impressed. So how have you got it set out? What kind of stuff are you growing?
So we've got 2 polytunnels up. As I say, the majority of the stuff we grow there is salad, because that's where the money is. We can sell salad to the restaurant trade for £12 a kilo, or to do the membership scheme for £14 a kilo, which absolutely pisses all over trying to sell like potatoes for 90p a kilo or something. So majority salad, that involves lettuces, it involves oriental brassicas, it involves chard, it involves different edible flowers. It's a really it's a really vibrant, diverse place. You know, if you look at our seed order each year, it probably totals buying in 40 different varieties and vegetables in total. So, you know, off a small compass, we've got a lot of biodiversity.
And I guess you probably don't suffer so much in the hungry gap, do you, at the end of the year? Because the greens is one of the things you can keep growing, isn't it?
Yeah, so one of the delights of growing salad is, first of all, it's high market price. Secondly, the diversity it involves. And thirdly, just the fact that it's really is croppable for almost all the year. So as I say, we crop 44 weeks of the year. I did my last salad harvest just last week. So that's mid-December. And we'll be able to start cropping again in February. Okay, so if you look at that compared to something like, I don't know, like, you know, another good equivalent to sort of related to, we say beetroot. So you could get three crops of beetroot through the year. You'd be able to store it maybe to mid-February, but you definitely wouldn't be able to harvest it 44 weeks a year like you can with salad.
Presumably all of your stuff has to be sold fresh. You can't do any storing of stuff, can you?
Yeah, it's all sold fresh, yeah. We harvest and deliver on the same day with a cargo bike.
So what kind of stuff would you be... So if people... I mean, also a kilo of salad is actually quite a lot. It really, that's got quite a massive lot of leaves. So say so in this time of year, if somebody's taking your salads off you for their 14 quid or whatever, what are they getting?
So a kilo is a lot. That's like for restaurant trade. That looks like a full carrier bag. But like... A large share from our salad drop scheme is 350 grams. That'll be salad for a good four or five people for a week. And it will involve kale, chard, different kinds of lettuce, possibly miner's lettuce, one of my faves, always sorrel and a couple of edible flowers.
Great, yeah. Jess has been feeding me weeds for ages. And very tasty, some of them are. I was having some American land cress just this morning. And it was really, really nice. And another one we've had that's been really successful, even we've had -7, -8 frosts, and the chard is still going strong. One of the things about the leaves, of course, is you don't really need light to make them flower, do you? They will just grow all the year round. So what was it that, I mean, I'd like to come and see that now. I want to come and see your acre and see what you're doing with it, because that's... I've got a lot of experience of growing veg, and it's not so much of growing salad, especially now that I haven't got any teeth. But I'd really like to see how you've got it organised to turn that out. And what was it that got you into it? How come you ended up kind of running that kind of project?
So I had quite a sort of like unusual probably entrance into being a grower. I really came to it not from the practical side, but from the political side. I really got interested in the politics of the food system, in land-based politics, and kind of thought, actually, at the end of the day, the most practical thing to be doing with this is not only to be working at a political and policy level, but also to be getting my hands in the soil and to be churning out food and to understand the agricultural community, understand agricultural systems. And so I kind of came to it from that angle, took an allotment, started to learn how to grow, and I'm not naturally practical, so it was a long, hard road actually, and it took me years to actually become a confident grower. But sort of 5 years down the line, I now feel like I've actually, yeah, turned myself into a competent and confident grower.
And I would guess on something like that, you must have a fair number of people helping you. Are they sort of volunteers? Is it a big crew? What have you got with you, or is it all just you?
So there's two of us really, and we've had a bit of extra seasonal labour this year. So it's mainly me, Humphrey Lloyd, and Sid Goldsmith, who actually also co-wrote the song that we heard earlier, The Ballad of Yorkley Court. And this year we've had some seasonal help from a few other friends, namely Tommy Butt, who works at Purple Patch, another local growing project. But, you know, I do the majority of the labour.
We were hoping to have Mary from Purple Patch on this evening, but she couldn't make it. So I think there's probably going to be another trip to Bristol, though. And I noticed you were wearing a Land Workers Alliance sweatshirt earlier on, weren't you? Are you associated and working with them as well?
Yeah, so I spend a lot of time, particularly in these winter months when the field gives me a bit of time off. My main activity is working with the Land Workers Alliance. I'm a member of their core group and an active member.
And how do they manifest themselves in Bristol? Because they're pretty massive, aren't they? They've got many millions of members worldwide. How does it look in Bristol?
Okay, so to give you, I'll go right from the global to the local perspective. The Land Workers Alliance is the UK's branch of the international peasant movement called La Via Campesina. Okay, so this is a giant international peasants union that amasses no less than 200 million people worldwide. This is by far the world's biggest social movement. And essentially their project... it's promote the politics of food sovereignty. So that, what that means is taking control of the food system, making it democratic, making it fair, and making it sustainable. Okay. Now, the Via Campesina as an international movement has existed globally since 1993. But we established the branch for England and Wales just 4 years ago here in the UK. And that's called the Land Workers Alliance. A little aside is that there has historically been a Via Campesina group called the Scottish Crofters in Scotland for much longer. And that's actually still today a much bigger and more powerful organisation than the Land Workers Alliance here is in England and Wales. Anyway, so 4 years ago, we established the Land Workers Alliance. It started as a meeting of 12 people in a room in Bristol, kindly donated by the Soil Association for a morning. We've now swelled to a membership of some 600 people. We're working on doing skill shares and other sort of social activities to swap information about agroecology between farmers. We're doing direct action. We're working on policy and producing documents. We're really creating a farmers movement for a farming community to promote agroecology, sustainable farming and food sovereignty here in the UK.
So you're actually, you're interacting with members of parliament and stuff like that on questions of policy. Are you making any progress with them?
The road is slow. As we know, you know, the main body representing agriculture in the UK is the National Farmers Union. The National Farmers Union have their head office next door to the head office of DEFRA in Smith Square, central London. Essentially, one of our main projects is to try and create some kind of counterweight to the political voice of the NFU, which essentially is a representative for large-scale agriculture, industrial agriculture. For example, they are openly pro-GM and have done very little to make any kind of countermand to the single farm payment, which is a prop up to land ownership, for example. So us presenting this alternative political agenda, yes, we have had some inroads. We have had a meeting with George Eustace, the agricultural minister. We've been feeding into the all-party parliamentary group on agroecology. We fed into an event called Farmers in Parliament earlier this year. And as a little sneaky aside, we also did an event at the Treasury, which wasn't wholly condoned, but we did rock up with a van with 2 30-foot ladders in and dropped a banner off the front of the Treasury that read, "Public land for public good." And that was a piece of direct action in collaboration with La Via Campesina Global as part of April 17th, the Day of Agrarian Struggle.
Yeah, I know you had something to say on that one, Ben.
I know that you're working with small producers. What about people who have allotments? Are you part of, open to them being involved, people doing it as a non-commercial project? What about that?
It's a really good question. And in establishing the Land Workers Alliance, this was quite a big debate we had for quite a long time. Do we essentially lessen people who are doing this part-time as a hobby, or is it exclusively for people who are basically making their livelihood off the land? In the end, what we decided is that the membership criteria is essentially self-selective. So what we say is people who spend a substantial amount of their time producing food are encouraged to be members of the Land Workers Alliance. My honest feeling is really this comes from the history of trade unions, and it's essentially as a union as well as a campaign group. So I kind of more err on the side that this is it's to represent professional land workers, really. But it's subjective.
So what's quite interesting is for Bristol Food Producers, which is an organisation to support local producers in and around Bristol, we've ended up going for a different approach because there aren't really enough producers to kind of sustain the organisation through memberships alone. So we actually actively encourage supporter memberships. So people can pay £15 a year and become a supporter member of Bristol Food Producers. And as a supporter member, you know, you get access to the same thing, but most of it's focused on the producer members. So your money is really just going to produce to support the work we're doing with them. But the way that we've structured it quite carefully in that collectively the percentage voice that those members have is kept to quite a small amount compared to the producer members, so that it's kind of very much keeping the needs and the voices of the producer members at the forefront.
That's actually a very interesting distinction you've made there, because this is actually a Fire in the Mountain hosted gig, because Ali, one of my fellow core crew members on Fire in the Mountain, has given us all the space to do this and has organised for all these great people to come and talk to us. And that's exactly one of the things we identified at the AGM and also at the land cooperative that we're working with, is that there needs to be a distinction between the people who want to provide a bit of money and the people who actually want to get involved. Have you seen that has that got kind of wider applications?
Yeah, I mean, I think we found there's definitely a lot of people who just want to give a little bit and want to help out. Like, we've just actually run a crowdfunder to support our work for the next year. And I've been just astounded by the generosity of people who just want to see this happen. And, you know, people who found themselves in situations where they have got a bit of spare cash and, you know, have willingly given us, you know, a fairly generous amount of money just to help do the work. And they don't want anything back from that. You know, like on one of the crowdfunder awards, I actually wrote that you get a warm and fuzzy feeling. Because I was like, if you're giving that much money, there's no point offering somebody something tangible for that. They are doing it just from the goodness of their heart.
At last we're reaching the real, real philanthropists who tend to be the poorest rather than the richest in my experience. And what about your film, Humphrey? What are you doing there?
Okay, so one of the projects that the Land Workers Alliance has been working on in 2016 is producing a film. So we're producing this film called In Our Hands, and it's about the food system and how we can change it. And this has been a collaboration between myself, Humphrey Lloyd, as the producer, and two fantastic directors called Joe Barker and Sylvie. Not quite sure what Sylvie's surname is, but never mind. We've been making this film all year, and just to give you a super quick roundup, essentially what it does is it tells you the story of the monopolization of power within the food system over the last 100 years. Okay, so just to give you one example, if we look at seeds, for example, seed hybridization was only invented in the late 19th century. Before that, all seeds were open pollinated. All farmers saved their own seed and used their own seed. Since then, we've had the growth of a global seed industry and the science of hybridization of seed and genetic modification of seed and the conglomeration of various giant global seed companies. The result of this is that now three seed companies control 53% of the global seed market. You know what? I tell a lie. That was the case before the Bayer and Monsanto merger this year. So now it's more like two companies control over half of all seed globally. So what this story does, it tells that story. It tells the dysfunctions of that kind of food system. For example, environmental degradation, loss of agricultural jobs from mechanization, and cheap food that poisons us because it's full of salt and sugar. So it tells that story, and then it tells the challenges that are being made to that system by innovative farmers here on the earth in the UK. So for example, we go to Organically in East London, a growing project that's engaging young people and community in growing. And then we go to Agrazia in Wales, who's doing really innovative stuff with holistic plant grazing, which is developing soils. And then we go to a micro dairy, a guy called Josh in North Aston, where they're supporting 2.5 incomes of 20 grand a year off a cow herd of 17 cattle. Okay. All because they're bottling their own milk and selling it direct to the consumer. So they are getting £1.15 per litre rather than the derogatory 9p a litre that is standard for dairy farmers to get in the UK today. So it's a story of power and control, but the resistance of power and control that is coming from small scale farmers in the UK.
Don't you start to get the feeling that the time is now, guys? Don't you just listening to these people? So that sounds, again, totally brilliant. When do we get to see it? Is it going to be a launch night? Do we get cheese and wine?
So we launch our what's called the Taster, which is basically an extended trailer at the Oxford Real Farming Conference on the 5th of January this year in Oxford. The full feature film, which is going to be about an hour long, will probably not be ready till April, but that basically watch this space. It will be launched around the UK. We're hoping to do 20 launches around the UK if we get the required funding. And basically with each launch, we'll have a panel discussion from local farmers. And we're really going to use this as a tool, not only to get more members for the Land Workers Alliance, but really to just to sort of build conversations about the food system and food sovereignty in the UK.
Would you like to do a live show from the Oxford Farming Conference?
Hell, why not?
We'll see what we can do. My people can do lunch with your people. We'll see what we'll sort out. Thanks very much, Humphrey. That, again, was really inspiring. There's people waving their arms in the air here. Let's hear it for Humphrey as well. That was really great. It's really exciting for me. This is, I should come to the city more often, you know. Well, we're going to have another quick music break before we go and chat with Ben about what's been happening with squatting in Bristol since the new squatting laws and all that kind of stuff and whether they're all still managing to survive. We're going to have another of Jimmy Aldrich and Sid Goldsmith's tunes called Night Hours. But before that, we've got my mate Litmus A. Freeman and his tune Feeding the Machine, which is what you're doing, folks, if you're not doing what these people are doing. Think about it.
Said to me as I left school, you need a job to pay your way. 'Cause things cost money and you're gonna need things. That's just the way things are today. So I left home and went to work at just 16. Started feeding the machine. My brother,
moved into a flat. I paid my share of bills and rent. I got paid on a so-called Thursday, and by Sunday night it was gone. That's how the weekends are all spent. And when the calendar's got you slaving for the 5 days in between, you're just feeding the machine. Got married, we had a couple of kids. I love them dearly to this day. But to put food on our table, put clothes on our backs, I needed lots more pay. I got me a work promotion, but the tax man stripped me clean. I'm mostly feeding his machine. I had to get a big loan. That's called a mortgage, I hear you cry. And that means death pledge. And that's because it feels like you're paying till you die. And most of it's interest that goes to the banks to dream. They love us feeding their machine. Got me a raise, I kept aiming for the top. But as my pay went up, so did my debts, and the interest never stops. I met me a bankster, he said, son, you may be keen, but you're just feeding my machine. Began to realize what was going on, and how those banksters call the shots. They run the system, all based on debt. Lending money they ain't got. So it don't matter if you work hard, if you're generous or mean. From what I've seen, you're just feeding the machine. I did miss some learning about how it all works, and how they trick you right from birth. Your name is money to them when you're playing the surf, but your sweat and your talent's what you really worth. But if you're reaping what you're sowing at the ignorance latrine, shit, you're just feeding the machine. And if you don't know where you're going and you're not sure where you've been, probably feeding the machine. But when your wisdom is showing you what a fool you've been, you'll stop feeding the machine. Let's stop feeding the machine. We're all feeding the machine. So let's stop feeding the machine.
I've been working through the night. I've been working. Night hours in a world forgot. On my own here I can see the way things are going. I've been working until the half light. I've been up when your thoughts are not. The night hours in a world forgot. On my own here I can see the way things are going. Been working, kept out of sight. In the quiet, unlocked by the night. The night hours in a world forgot. On my own here I can see the way things are going. I've been working, working hard to make sense. So it all. I've been watching as the city sleeps. I am a man forgot. I'm here when your thoughts are numb. The night hours in a world forgot. On my own here I can see the way things are going.
Lovely tune that was. Night Hours from Jimmy Aldrich and Sid Goldsmith, and I suspect we'll probably be hearing more from them. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on autonomousmedia.net, and we've been talking so far to Stephen Humphrey about growing food and various other radical moves that we might consider making to improve our lot. And now we're going to be chatting with Ben, because it is a subject that's been covered on the show before, the business of living in houses that you don't necessarily own and aren't necessarily paying rent for. something that, as we know, the government endeavoured to legislate against. Now, I'm really aware, as are many people, that Bristol was a big place for squats. Ben, how's it survived this kind of onslaught from the legislature?
Well, in 2012, I thought, basically, this is it, quite frankly. And I thought we've had about 20-plus years of squatting, 20 more than that. And I really was very worried. But what people have done is just adapted to the new rules. So you can squat in anything that's, rather weirdly, you can squat in anything that's not designed to be a house. So if it's a garage or a, you know, a public toilet or something, you can live there. But if it's a house, you can't. So we were now in a very surreal world where people identify places that were formerly industrial or commercial and make use of what they can. And there's a lot of them around. There's the most obvious one. It's a great big post office place, as you see as you come into Temple Meads, as you get off the train. There's that huge derelict building, obviously not livable, but that's the kind of building that people are now adapting to live in.
You had a lot of squats here before that law came about, though. I mean, presumably a lot of people had to move on. Have they been absorbed some way, or are they still on the streets? What happened to them?
There's quite a high turnover with squatting. Lots of people just go on and get some place of their own. Some people, unfortunately, do become homeless. And then there's always the core of people that think, well, we're just going to continue doing what we're doing. We'll stay in buildings. We'll stay in tents. We'll go out to the countryside. Some people go to places like Yorkley that we've just talked about. And it varies. So although it looks terrible at the beginning that everything's going to fall apart, it just seems to go down a bit and grow again. It's a bit seasonal, you know. So people never really give up, because the issue never goes away, that we just don't have enough housing for people to live in, affordable housing.
So does that mean that all squatting's now, or squatting, we'll call it that because that's the word they use. I don't think it's necessarily quite the right word, not the word I choose to use, but does that mean that all of this kind of unofficial living is now happening in commercial premises?
Well, officially, the trouble is, obviously, if anything goes illegal, you just can't talk about it. So I won't say anything about that. But I assume there are very surreptitious people who are doing whatever they can. There's, on this subject, I've got a friend of mine who does live surreptitiously, and his favorite book is called Advanced Fugitive, which I think is from the United States or Canada. I don't know what it covers. Yeah. Yes. I think it was on Loon Panic Books, which have gone out of print. But if you want to be an advanced fugitive, then you can live in a residential building. Otherwise, you just adapt to the new law.
The funny thing is, I mean, I would assume it's the same around here. Even though we've got a huge housing crisis and stuff in Wales, there are loads and loads and loads of empty flats, empty houses, empty farms, empty holiday cottages. There's just shed loads of it. Are you seeing lots of empty buildings that people are just somehow no longer allowed to use, or is it that there's no more empty buildings?
There's empties everywhere. Avonmouth is virtually a ghost town. I just heard from a friend of mine who's going to do a freedom of information check on the subject that the council have about 300 places set aside for minor repairs. So that could be a cracked window, bad paint job, anything tiny. They've taken it off the availability list. So as we look into it more and more, we discover more and more layers of unused buildings of all kinds. Now, we're not quite sure why this is, but there's a suggestion that somehow there's some corruption going on, because there's no need to take a building off the availability list for housing if it's just got a broken window. I mean, you know, all of us around here will mend a window, surely.
Plus the fact it doesn't sound like your county council might be absolutely maximising what it might be doing with your council tax and stuff. You know, it can't possibly be in the council's interest to have places with a crack window lying empty, you wouldn't have thought. So that means your official squatting and stuff's happening in commercial buildings. Is there a lot of that going along? How did that start? Because presumably most people were in domestic rather than buildings that they couldn't actually live in. How have they adapted to that?
There's always been squatting in all sorts of places. So people do have some ability to live in unusual circumstances. They've just developed that ability. So people have divided up huge places like factories into smaller subsections. People have learnt different forms of electrical work and different forms of plumbing. gathering water. So people have developed their own skills as they've needed to. And one of the most amazing things is that how adaptable people are and how good really people are at learning new skills because they've got to do it. So in a way, it's been a challenge. The really unfortunate thing, of course, is that those who can't adapt, those who are most at risk, are the people that fall by the wayside. And we've become a society in which if you can adapt, you're okay. But it's very Darwinian, and it's not a very nice thing to do to people, that there are thousands of people that really just need assistance but don't get it. But if you can manage, you can manage.
And are the people that can manage managing to help at least a few of those that can't?
Well, that's basically the general outlook of our group, which hasn't got a sort of written down political strategy. But basically, most people think that we should help other people. Some people are annoyingly difficult to help, but you know, the general idea is that you help people out, even if you think I couldn't live with them, but I will make sure they've got somewhere to go. You know. So it's a self-help and sharing experience, even if there's a difference, I think, between general solidarity, which is that you help everyone, and a community, which is that you work with people you actually get on with. But they're both important, but they're slightly different approaches, you know.
Yeah, one thing I've always noticed, I've only squatted for a short time in the past, kind of relatively recently, but, you know, on a positive note, to see some people who squat get a space to give a lot to other people, and that's something that I really admired, and, you know, positive of a lot of people squatting, a lot of people going through a lot of difficult times, a lot of mental health problems, if you want to put it in those words. But yeah, one thing that really amazed me is like an ability for humans to reach out if they're given some space and something over their head which doesn't cost them time and money. Yeah,
thanks, Ali. I would imagine that in the kind of process of transition, you had to have some interface with authorities of one sort or another, uniformed and plastic badged and the like. How many of them were there and how did you deal with it?
There was a changeover of police commissioner. I don't know whether you knew. It's gone through an elaborate story of this. But we went from a fairly, I think there was a very right-wing commissioner. I've forgotten his name, but he was involved in Northern Ireland and basically preventing much happening there into investigations, the shoot to kill. Basically went from that to a more liberal person, and I think that helped. But at one stage, people did have to be on a roof of a commercial building for about 2 days while the police circulated and we were down outside helping them to stay alive, basically. And then the police there realised that there was no basis for what they were doing. I remember also being on a roof of a pub that was completely derelict and the police helicopter being sent up because we were mending the roof, me and another person. And I thought, this must be the most weird thing where you're being investigated for building work, you know. So, yeah, we did have an interesting year in 2013. But after that, I think they just backed off, realizing that there was nothing really much to investigate and it was a waste of police time and effort to look at people who are renovating buildings. So it's got a lot better since. If you squat in Broadmead, however, or around about Cabot Circus, they don't give you much time and they would move heaven and earth to get you out of the building, whatever.
That, I believe, being pretty much the commercial centre of Bristol, isn't it? They don't like people squatting in their commercial centres unless they're the right sort of people. So it's kind of coming together a bit then. Are you getting a chance since 2013 to stabilise and are you actually in communication with authorities to try and improve the situation, any?
Our main communication through various channels, I suppose, is with the Bristol City Council, who've changed since the May elections. It's a Labour council. They're a bit better. And they've basically said that they've got quite a lot of disposable property. So if we come up with a reasonable community organisation with a guarantee, they may be able to give us stuff at peppercorn rents. So that wouldn't be the squatting group. That would be like offshoots of the squatting group, a bit like the community land trusts in agriculture. And this offers a bit of hope to people. So we might be able to get hold of schemes that can involve redoing industrial property. We might even be able to get hold of land and do things like containers or straw build or, you know, because I think one of the good things is that we could have really original projects and have eco-villages and all sorts of things that you don't normally get in your normal building scheme. And then you could integrate food growing with that so that you've got a much more sustainable city which people would like to live in rather than all just live in a barrack home. And, you know,
if your council are anything like our council, they want the toilets and the railway lines and everything to be run by volunteers. And I suspect you're going to find that because you've developed all of the skills that they need, there may well be a chance to kind of explore new things there. Because again, it's not just the farming that's going to change, because at the root of it all is the money and all sorts of things that are really fundamentally dishonest. And I'd say, rather like the other projects we've heard about tonight, you're kind of doing the groundwork so that should the opportunity arise, you are actually going to have skilled people to wander in and, you know, help improve properties that you want to stay in. And it'd be really great if that's the way it turns out. I guess you're not. One of the things that's occurred to me is because me and Jess, we kind of turned our back on an awful lot of officialdom and stuff, and we've chosen to do things a different way. And although it has its challenges, I'd really far rather be doing what I'm doing now than being the fully accountable person that I was before. I mean, there must be some aspects of squatting that make it actually preferable to owning. Me and Jess, we don't want to own anything. Do you see it developing to the point where we can actually be happy doing that sort of stuff? Because these buildings need looking after and being in, don't they? They rot otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, when I squatted it, you were free. It was a very different feeling. I rent now in a housing co-op, which has got aspects of that. So it's just about being able to survive in the situation you've got and then seeing if you can actually make some more change. You know, even if you personally can't do it, you can be part of a network. One of our ideas is that you have backup. So if people are in a difficult situation, say they're living in a tent village, well, they're going to need backup. They can't do it on their own, like you're talking about people farming and all that. And farming communities aren't individual separate people. They're communities. And what we are is a squatting community. So there'll be people who are in tenancies. There'll be people who own their own homes. There'll be squatters. There'll be travellers. And we've built a network of people who help each other out, because that's infinitely more valuable than just being on your own in a property and not seeing any of your neighbours, you know. And actually, it's part of my life and part of most people's in the group's lives. It's about what it is to be human, really.
Seriously, think that's one of the things you give up when you have your own front door, or you're in danger of giving up. There's an interesting question from Jason, who's one of our hosts. He's with Raconteurs News, and he's saying, rather than the legalities of squatting, what does Ben think of the morality of squatting?
I always like to think about take an example of an abandoned car. Now, if you left your car somewhere random in the city and let it rot, it wouldn't be allowed to be there for a year. It would just be taken away and crushed as a nuisance. And similarly, an abandoned building is a public nuisance. It can encourage all sorts of things, from arson to vermin to children could go on and be injured, all sorts of things. It's not simply a waste, it's actually a danger. So I think if people are careful about what they do, they don't go into people's houses and when they've gone on holiday and all that sort of stuff. If they identify somewhere that's getting no use whatsoever, they're actually doing a public good. They're doing something that protects the city. If you imagine the whole area desolate and derelict, like I think what the Bronx became in the 1970s in New York. Now, this just became a really dangerous place because no one was there apart from people who were just desperate. And they have actually completely renovated that part of New York by putting community groups into and redeveloping the entire area. So the morality is that if you abandon something, you aren't simply just leaving a handkerchief on the ground. You're actually destroying the city. You know, but places like Avonmouth, you can wander around the ghost towns. Now, just simply because you own something doesn't mean that you can just ignore the social effects of what you're doing. I think it's very important for people when they say, well, you're taking over people's property. But those people have abandoned some of the duties of property. It's a bit like land. If you just let it become a mess, is that all right? Not really, is it?
No, that's all. I think a very, very good point. And really, I mean, it's been established, hasn't it, with the skip diving thing. There was a lot of trouble initially because people want to stop people going into skips and pulling stuff out. But it's abandoned goods. The houses are abandoned goods. It's a bit like, though, we've found solutions to all sorts of financial problems, but the mortgage is a real hard nut to crack. Because, of course, at the seat of wealth, of Hulth, is the land. And in the legal definitions, the land includes anything that man put there, which includes the buildings, you know. So it does seem crazy to be letting this stuff rot. And I tend to agree with you that there is a kind of imperative to get in there and try and keep it up. And, you know, if it was anything other than a house, you know, if you saw other stuff lying around that you chose to drag off the pavement and take home, you'd be regarded as doing the place a bit of a favour. Whereas somehow you're a kind of threat to society just because you're trying to move into something which otherwise had been permanently owned by the bank. That's something that I've been trying to suggest to people, is that even if a mortgage is paid off pretty quickly, that house is going to get sold to somebody else, and once again, it'll be under a mortgage. Nearly everything, even the things that people believe they own, are actually owned by the banks, you know? And in a way, those people are facing the same kind of problem as the people who are squatting. It's just that they don't realise it. It's a kind of common human problem, I think.
On that, if you become ill or elderly, you're forced to sell your own home. So you spent years and years of your life getting somewhere, only to discover at the end of your life, instead of any security or being able to give it to anybody, it goes back to the bank, as you say. So it's a kind of treadmill. And I think, unfortunately, that those who are in power, this is the treadmill is what they would like to keep going, that you don't have anything of yours whatsoever. And the move to the cashless economy and all the rest of it is just an advance to this treadmill continual.
So it's easy to think that squatters have got some kind of moral problem, but in fact, it's an illusion, the security of everything else. We are all merely a shadow's width from needing to seek that kind of solution ourselves, I feel. You've been three absolutely fabulous guests. Thank you, all of you, and Ali as well, for inviting them all on Dr. Rock. And I really hope that I get a chance to chat to you all again. I've stuck your various websites and stuff into the chat box. Anybody got any closing thoughts before we play some tunes and stuff?
It's just really great to have this spot on an independent radio show. It's great to have an alternative voice. Dr. Rock, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the tunes. Massive big up to Dr. Rock's radio show.
Just to say, it's been really great, and I'm really pleased to be able to meet completely different people that I never knew existed in Bristol, so it's been amazing. Thank you.
I think for me, as much as I've enjoyed the show, I've also enjoyed bits in between that everyone who's listening to this hasn't heard. All the conversations that had around the table over the songs and like we ate together before. And that's been a really, really great part of that as well.
Excellent stuff. A new bundle of people brought together in the cause of Dr. Rock. And I really seriously hope it's easy for me to get down here. And I'd really like to do this sort of thing again. I'd really like to tie up Humphrey when your film goes to that conference. You know, I'm happy to slip you a fiver or whatever. But yeah, we could come along, we could broadcast live from there and you can think about that and give us people to talk to. Really cracking. So it sounds like there's going to be more Dr. Rock shows born out of this one, which is why you've been having to put up with me for the last 6 years, because that just keeps happening. So, because what's going to happen now is there's going to be lots of chatter and noise. I don't suppose I'll get a chance to do a lot more talking. So what we'll do is we'll play some tunes through till midnight, that's it, sorry, having a bit of difficulty working out the 24-hour clock there. And we'll be listening to the tunes and talking over them, and I'll be back with you next Thursday. So expect some festive fun over the next couple of weeks or so. and in the meantime, here's the Kinks and State of Confusion.